This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Bees are vital to the American food system. Honeybees alone contribute more than $15 billion to the U.S. economy. They pollinate plants that produce fruits, nuts, and vegetables. There's a big drop in the number of pollinators over the past few decades, and there are a number of reasons, including pesticide exposure, climate change, and habitat loss. Much of the attention has been focused on the decline of the honeybee. But a new exhibit at the North Carolina Botanical Garden explores the health and significance of many native bee species in North Carolina. Behold, the Humble Pollinator is the exhibit that highlights more than 500 bee species that call North Carolina home. It looks at efforts to save them. The exhibit is part of a series of events called Saving Our Pollinators. And I'm joined by two guests who've contributed to that exhibit. Elsa Youngstead is an entomologist who works at the North Carolina State University. Welcome, Elsa. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Hi, Frank.
Also with us, Ann Lindsay, a retired botanist who helped coordinate the exhibit. Hello, Ann.
Hi, thank you.
So we actually need to, because everybody thinks they know what pollination is, but really we don't. Tell us more about pollination. What is it, kind of how does it work, and why is it so important?
Pollination is the critical part of the flower's life cycle, where pollen is deposited on the stigma of the flower. The pollen delivers the sperm to the egg and the ovary and produces our fruits and seeds that feed the world.
So we have a nice little plant there, but if we want to eat anything from it, it must be fertilized, and that's what pollen does, not just the sort of the inputs that we put into the ground. So tell us about the range of pollinators and how bees fit into the picture.
There are a large range of pollinators, flowers diversified in the Cretaceous with all of the insects that pollinate, beetles and flies and bees and butterflies and moths. But bees, by far, have become the most important pollinator, primarily because they depend on flowers for pollen, in particular, and nectar, for their entire life cycle. The females feed pollen and nectar mixtures to their larvae, and they feed on nectar themselves as adults.
You know, every spring, it occurs to me that the flowers don't need bees. There's just the wind seems to be doing just fine. So why do we need bees or other pollinators?
Wind is derived in flowering plants. So grasses and some of the trees are wind pollinated. But you'll find in most of the biomes of terrestrial habitats that the flowers are insect or animal pollinated.
You know, so they're specialized. Some can take it from the wind and others really need for that.
Some are specialized for wind pollination, like the grasses.
So they're just laying there just waiting for it.
They dangle their anthers out in the wind, and it has to be in a habitat or in a situation where the wind is directional so that the pollen is effectively moved to these waiting stigma.
They dangle their anthers in the wind. That is the title of my next novel. I'm going to get started on that after this. So Elsa, the decline of the bee certainly has been in the headlines in the past few years, and I know it's a complicated picture, but if you can give us some overview of what's been happening.
Sure. So most of the evidence, the reason we know we have a problem with bees, it really started with honeybees. People have been keeping honeybees in hives for millennia, so they're our most closely watched bee. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture statistics show how the number of colonies has been declining in the U.S. since the 50s. It's gone up a little bit in the past few years, but due to a disproportionate amount of effort and work on the part of beekeepers. There's been a ton of research as to what's going on with honeybees, why they're declining, and the picture that's emerging, like you said, is complex, but many different factors seem to contribute. One of the big ones is new pests and diseases that have been introduced to the country in the past, you know, since the mid-1980s, that weaken honeybees or, for example, varroa mites that weaken them, weaken their immune system, transmit viruses. There are also nutritional issues. Bees are increasingly asked to forage on vast acreages of one single kind of plant, monoculture cropland. And just like us, honeybees are dietary generalists. They can't really get by on only one food, so they need a variety of things to remain healthy. That's a contributing factor. And kind of behind that is the habitat issue. Like, they need to be able to get to natural or sort of wild areas with a variety of plants. And then, of course, there is pesticide exposure in the picture, and that can tend to, at the concentrations they tend to encounter most often on properly treated plants, it's not an out-and-out deadly thing, but it can increase their susceptibility to other problems. So that's what we know about honeybees. If that's happening to honeybees, what's going on with all our native bees? There's more than 4,000 kinds in the country, more than 500 in North Carolina.
Well, that's something I wanted to stop you there because we don't often think of it. They think about bees as sort of these wild animals. But in fact, when we're talking about honeybees, we're talking about a domesticated animal, right? And then there are these wild bees, as you say, thousands of species out there, I think 500 or so just in North Carolina, right?
That's right.
So tell us about them and their lives and how, and what do we know about how they're doing?
So, like you said, there's more than 500 in North Carolina. It's a huge diversity. We have a lot of the diversity of the whole east coast of the U.S. Like in the mountains, we have some of the more northern species. On the coast, we have some of the more southern species. And as you, if you go out and just sort of watch flowers over the whole season from the beginning of March or the end of February through November, you'll see this parade of different kinds of bees visiting them. In the spring, you'll see things like mining bees, cellophane bees. Blueberry bees are one of my favorite early spring bees. It's a bee that actually has a strong preference for blueberry flowers and is an economically important pollinator of them. If you go out right now, some of my favorite bees that you'll see are longhorned bees. If you look in your squash flowers in the morning, you may see squash bees. Just saw them in my yard this week. They're very specialized on
squash
plants.
If I see a blueberry bee in my squash, do I tell it to move or just let it go?
They probably won't ever meet, actually. The blueberry bees are back underground and not flying by the time your squash will bloom.
Okay.
So
lots of different kinds doing lots of different work. And I want to ask Anne about that, some specific examples in which native bees are crucial and kind of how they work and how they might work differently in terms of pollination than honeybees.
Ah, very good. Actually, native bees are very important and have been shown in many instances to be more effective than honeybees. There are relationships between bees and specific flowers often in which the female bees will only visit the certain plants, and that's a kind of fidelity that's very important to the plant. There is a form of anther called a porcidal anther that in which the pollen can only be extracted by vibrating the muscles of the bee. Honeybee will not do this. Native bees, bumblebees, and other native bees will. So blueberries are an example of something that's affected by buzz pollination. Tomatoes are require buzz pollination. And in fact, bumblebees, the eastern bumblebee is used in commercial greenhouse production of tomatoes for that reason.
Well, I do want to stop you there. So because I'm thinking when I think of any bee, including a honeybee, that it buzzes, which I think about as vibration. But you're saying that there are particular plants that need a specific kind of vibration that only comes from certain bees to actually extract the pollen. Is that what you mean?
Elsa can help me here, but I think it's just the muscles of their bodies that vibrate. And they're actually, bumblebees are used to doing that to warm up their hive.
Mm-hmm. It is a special sort of buzzing behavior. I mean, any bee, when it flies by, it'll make a buzzing sound with its wings, but only some of them, when they arrive at a flower and grab onto it, will they kind of redirect their flight muscles from making their wings flap and fly to vibrating their whole body in the flower, and that makes the pollen pop out of, you know, certain kinds of flowers that otherwise wouldn't release it.
You think this is a behavior that they have adapted in order to extract pollen? Because they don't really need the pollen, right? I mean, that's ancillary to what they're doing.
The bees need the pollen.
Well,
that's what they collect to feed their young. So the bumblebee colony will amass huge amounts of pollen to raise the larvae to make the next generation of worker bees. Same thing with our native, bumblebees are native, but many of our native bees are solitary. So unlike honeybees and bumblebees, which live in big colonies, most of them it's every bee for herself. So each female bee will dig a nest, collect all her own pollen, lay her own eggs, and so she will collect many times her own body weight in pollen to feed her babies.
This whole time I'm thinking that they're extracting some kind of nectar and incidentally gather up this stuff that they then bring to the next flower.
So they're eating the nectar too. Like the adult bees that need that as their own fuel. And then they're mostly, they eat some of the pollen and then they feed it to their kids.
And not all extraction is alike. Not only do they, are they specialized in extracting, but the way and the amount of pollen that they gather differs from bee to bee. Can you tell us more about that? That there are bees that kind of revel in this stuff and others that just are really only gathered on the bees' knees, as it were?
Right. So honeybees and bumblebees have a particular sort of pollen storing apparatus on their legs. When they're out collecting, they moisten the pollen and then pack it into these special spots on their legs that are smooth and surrounded by hairs, and it stays very tidily there. Most of the native bees carry it on different parts of their bodies, on their bellies or just kind of all over their hind legs. They carry it loose and dry. And so it's more apt to fall off and pollinate things. Or even bumblebees, you know, there'll be certain parts of their head that they can't quite groom it off of. And it's the pollen from that part of the bee that will affect most of the pollination.
So do we know what's happening to the native bees? I mean, obviously, we're keeping very close track of honeybees because we cultivate them. But what about the wild bees?
We haven't kept nearly as close a track of them. It's occurred to people to really start looking since we noticed there was a problem with honeybees. So there are some surveys kind of long-term ongoing, but it's going to take a lot of time before those really tell us much. So right now, there's kind of two lines of evidence. One of them is just looking across different kinds of habitats to see which bees can live where and whether those habitats are growing or shrinking. So in the most urbanized areas and the most intensified agricultural areas, you tend to find fewer kinds or fewer numbers of native bees. And so if you look over kind of the history of land use, you know, urban areas and agricultural areas tend to be growing. So it stands to reason that we would have fewer native bees now than we used to. But the only direct evidence for change over time at this point comes from looking, comparing current surveys to historical collections of bees from museums. And there are really two main studies that have done that in the U.S. One has found pretty drastic shrinkage in the range occupied by several species of bumblebees. Bees that were previously very common across the whole eastern or whole western U.S. are now rare bees in very small areas. And it looks like they're suffering from a disease that's likely to have been introduced in the past few decades also. Maybe one of the things that's also bothering bumblebees, much as it is honeybees.
You've done some research on urban warming and its impact. Tell us more about that.
Right. So most of the work that I've been doing with urban warming, actually, I should say kind of everybody in the lab group that I'm working on, well, many members of the lab group that I work with are studying various aspects of urbanization, urban warming, and their effects on insects.
When we say urban warming, we're talking about the just urban areas are just warmer because of the concrete, et cetera. So there's just they give off more heat. Right?
Exactly. They're on average a couple degrees hotter than surrounding natural areas. And because insects, I mean, you could call them cold-blooded, they rely on the environment to determine their body temperature, their metabolism, urban warming should matter to them. I've looked at it mainly in pest insects called scale insects that can be detrimental to trees and other plants, and we find that those are more common in the hottest parts of the city, in Raleigh. And also, if you look historically at historical plant specimens, they have more of them in hot time periods. Mm. So the cities may actually even tell us something about what's going to happen in the future as our entire climate warms up. What does any of this have to do with bees? There's several ongoing projects that I'm involved in or that other members of the lab where I work are involved in looking at effects of urban warming and other aspects of urbanization on bees and their immune function, the diseases they carry, just where in the urban area they can and cannot live. All of those are fairly new projects, so I don't have a verdict to share, but hopefully in a couple of years we can tell you more.
Well, Anne, are we reaching a kind of danger point when it comes to pollinators, and is there anything that can be done?
Yes, I think we are, and it's unfortunate we don't have more hard data so that we can push that forward. But the good news is that pollinator gardening is becoming very, very popular. The botanical garden, which is a garden of native plants, has been pursuing this since its inception, is promoting native plants in the landscape. Part of the Saving Our Pollinators program, we'll have Doug Tallamy here, who is advocating for more native plants in the landscape. And the diversity of flowers that are out there, the more habitat we promote for bees, the healthier both our plant and our bee populations will be. So that's the hope for the future. More people doing pollinator gardens.
And Elsa, last month the White House issued its national strategy for improving the health of pollinators. Can you tell us a little more about that? What are some of the main strategies here?
Sure. Yeah, the new strategy, it focuses a lot on honeybees specifically and monarch butterflies, but there are a lot of points in there that will also benefit native bees. One of the big ones does address habitat, which is one of the clearest things that bees have to have and that they've been losing. And this plan, this strategy aims to restore 7 million acres of habitat, of pollinator habitat across the country in the next 5 years. So that's an area bigger than the state of Maryland, which is a fantastic start. It also presents plans to review some of the insecticides that are currently in use and increase the their toxicity testing in other bees besides just honeybees.
Is all habitat alike? In other words, do I have to have a certain amount to reach a kind of critical mass to be effective for the range of a species?
That's a great question, and I don't think we really know exactly how much it takes. We can also talk about how little it can take. Some bees, some of our smallest native bees, are like smaller than a grain of rice. They'll only fly a few hundred yards. So when you're thinking about restoring habitat, it kind of needs to all happen all at once in the same area. For example, a little bee always comes back to her same nest at the end of the day or to drop off her pollen. So if she can only fly a few hundred yards, she needs, you know, nesting habitat and flowers of either if she's a specialist bee, she needs that kind of flower, or if it's a generalist bee, she needs a whole diversity of flowers for a healthy, balanced diet within flying distance of the place that she's also nesting.
Fascinating stuff, and we can find out more at the exhibit, but I want to thank both of you for sharing this with us today. Elsa Youngstead is an entomologist who works at NC State University. Elsa, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Ann Lindsay helped coordinate the new exhibit at the North Carolina Botanical Garden. It's called Behold the Humble Pollinator. Thank you, Ann.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the State of Things. If you want to find out more about the exhibit or anything we talked about, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brett Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.